Welcome to Grow Your Influence, leadership conversations for business owners and managers. Whether you own a business and have a team, or leadership is part of your role, welcome, you're exactly where you need to be. Join co-hosts Juliette Robinson and Christy Lee Billett for their regular conversations on all things leadership. No corporate jargon, no textbook ideologies, just real life experience unpacked in a relaxed way to help you be your best boss and lead your team with confidence, clarity, and control. This is Grow Your Influence. Let's dive in. Hey there, it's Christy Lee here. Welcome to this episode of the Grow Your Influence podcast. In today's episode of the podcast, we're bringing you another interview with an expert guest who we're really, really lucky to have spoken to here on the podcast. Now, if you've been joining in our last couple of episodes, you'll know that Juliette and I have been tackling some very interesting topics around workplace dynamics, particularly around working with people who have different values and beliefs to our own and how we can navigate that in the most inclusive way possible. And that's why I was so excited to be able to bring you this interview with Nick Mills that I'm about to share with you. Now, Nick is an experienced facilitator, coach, and leadership expert. He has bachelor's and master's degrees in adult education. He also has an advanced diploma in the neuroscience of leadership, as well as a whole stack of other qualifications. He's incredibly well educated and a big studier. And Nick currently is part-time also with the University of Tasmania, where he is completing his PhD on how Australian companies can be more inclusive and welcoming spaces. He has a particular focus topic as part of his studies, which we do get into this interview, particularly with his background in the finance and professional services sectors. And he's motivated to help leaders have more meaningful interactions and more effective and sensitive conversations with team members across all areas of their organization. Now, we will get Nick back on the podcast once he has completed his PhD to learn even more about that. But I really hope you enjoy today's conversation with Nick, where he shares what he's learned along the way with his PhD and, of course, through all of his years of experience, and how we as Australian businesses can be more truly inclusive and welcoming places. So let's welcome Nick to the podcast. Nick Mills, I am so excited to be having this conversation with you today. Welcome and thank you for joining me.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Now, I've given our listeners a formal introduction for you, your official bio, but I always think it's better to hear directly from our special guests about what they do, why they do what they do, and a little bit about their background. So do you want to tell everyone a little bit about yourself and your background and what you're doing at the moment?
Sure, thank you. Well, first of all, thanks for the opportunity to come on and talk this afternoon. It's I think this topic is really important and very close to my heart, and so yeah, I'm excited to talk about it. So I'm a self-employed consultant, coach, facilitator, trainer. I work in the corporate space and have done for about 14 years. I mainly train in things like leadership and sales across, you know, small and large organizations across pretty much every industry sector. And I've been doing that since I was made redundant from my last full-time job, which is in a finance company, and I was made redundant during the GFC. And I had worked in the finance industry, in the travel industry for many, many years in sort of operations, management, sales, and training roles across sort of 20 years or so. So this is like a really logical transfer for me. Mm-hmm. As well as that, I'm a bit of an education junkie, and I keep going back to university and doing various things. And about 6 years ago, I went part-time in my business and I went back to university as a part-time grad student to complete my PhD, which I'm hopefully going to be hitting submit by the end of this year if I'm still focused.
if you're diligent.
yeah. And my subject area is essentially looking at the experience of people from marginalized backgrounds who work in finance industries, banks, law firms, professional services companies like your big four consulting companies, etc. These companies have always scored incredibly well in things like diversity and inclusion indexes, not just in Australia, but globally. In fact, some of the well-known brands that we all know in Australia in terms of the big four banks, the big four consulting companies like, you know, your Deloitte and EY, etc., as well as your top 10 law firms, all often do really, really well in those things. And in part, that's because they go on the front foot and they were really well funded in terms of their diversity and inclusion efforts. But I kind of wanted to dig into that and have a look at, well, what were the real stories like for people working in those industries? You know, what's it like for me working in my role as an accountant or a lawyer or, you know, a manager of a business advisory service team within one of those companies? You know, if I'm somebody who identifies as, you know, gay or bisexual or queer or trans or whatever, what's my experience like on a day-to-day basis? Because as most of us know, when we talk about, when we, you know, go to barbecues and dinner parties and people say what to do for a living, and we talk about our company or the organization or who we work for, and we start describing it, you know, the goods and the pros and the cons, et cetera, what we're actually talking about is the culture of the organization.
Mm.
And most of the time when we're talking about that, we're actually talking about a pretty small group of people. And usually that's our immediate team and our immediate manager and the people that we interact with them mostly. Mm. And therefore, we have a series of words and phrases and things to describe this culture. But the culture of an organization is actually us, because organizations are essentially made up of people. It doesn't matter what we actually do.
Mm-hmm. You
know? So, yeah, I kind of wanted to sort of dig in underneath and find out, you know, what people's actual experience is there.
Mm. I think that's really fascinating. And I must say, I applaud you for going back to studies, because the thought to me of returning to uni some, I don't know, 20 years after finishing my master's makes me want to cry. And whilst I love the idea of doing some research, I just don't think I have it in me to go back to do a PhD kind of study. So I applaud you for that tenacity and that grit to get through that, because I don't think it's an easy feat at all.
Oh, there's been plenty of tears.
Yeah, exactly. But I think what you're looking into is actually really interesting, because it's interesting that you point out that a lot of the really big firms, the big fours, a lot of the firms that do rate well, if you were to look at a survey of whether it's diversity and inclusion or a whole range of other workplace metrics, they do well because, as you pointed out, they're well-funded. It's not hard for them to participate in every possible thing, event, initiative under the sun. But does that actually mean that the people working in those workplaces feel included, feel safe psychologically, feel like they belong? And it's interesting to look at what's happening on the ground, because I work mainly with small businesses, and I always say to them, there's no point having a policy for a policy's sake or a document for a document's sake. It's got to actually do something, and it's got to be reflected in our behaviour in the workplace. Did you find that there was a difference between perhaps what was on paper and what was put in place in terms of initiative was different to what was happening actually on the ground with the people you spoke to?
So that's a good question. And the short answer is yes, but the answer is much more complex than that, because I not only do I look at some of the bigger well-known organisations, I also looked at things like, you know, small law firms in even in things like places like regional Queensland. Mm. And I also looked at finance startups where, you know, you don't have, and some of the ones that I interviewed, they didn't even have HR people yet, even though they had 50 or 100 staff or whatever. Mm. So they were growing so quickly, and that hadn't been their focus yet. The short answer is, generally for small organisations, it's a little bit more of the Wild West. Mm. The legislation is the same across all organisations. For small organisations, there isn't necessarily the resources or the manpower to be able to carry that out.
Mm.
And if you did have an issue with, you know, your manager or somebody in your team or somebody in another team, often there isn't that kind of, you know, one or two or three people removal that you might have in a much larger organisation, or you simply don't have a HR business partner to go and talk to in confidence.
Mm. And in a small business too, even if you do have access to HR, or there is someone wearing the HR hat, which often necessarily isn't a HR person, they're also friendly with everyone else in the business. So I think there is also a little reluctance necessarily that might be a trusted and independent or confidential space to go when you know that they're having lunch with the person you've got an issue with, or, you know, those types of things tend to happen. So it is more concentrated in small business, isn't it?
In one organisation, one person I interviewed, the CEO, this guy had a good relationship with the CEO, but the CEO's sister was the part-time HR business partner and advisor. And so he had some stuff and some things said to him, and he was really reluctant to go to either of those people to talk about, you know, what had been said to him in the workplace. And this is a 52-year-old, intelligent, experienced, very articulate man who's got a lot of experience working at big companies and or government, had suddenly come to a startup and just gone.
Yeah, because the structures aren't there. Yeah, especially if these people are coming out of corporate where there's been all the structure in the world, it must feel like they're quite alone in many ways in terms of having access to processes and people to speak to.
It's true, but that isn't to give big corporates and big organisations that do have those processes and systems in place a free pass.
Mm.
Because at the end of the day, we can do everything we want for things like we can do a big celebration for International Women's Day. We can do Black History Month. You know, we can do Pride Month in June. We can do all of these different events that happen during the year. But if we then take down the library and the bannering for this one and put it up for the next thing without actually necessarily making people who fit into those categories feel like they actually belong there and that they can actually have a good conversation with their manager, then...
Yeah, none of those things matter, I think, at the end of the day. What's happening actually on the ground where it matters is reflected.
Most definitely. And what I will say is that generally, like 100% hands down, the experience is it is getting better and a lot better.
Mm.
And particularly the younger people that are coming through that I interviewed, I think the youngest person I interviewed was about 30 and I had three or four or five people in their 30s.
Mm.
Their experience was completely different to people I interviewed in their 50s and early 60s. Because a lot of that stuff has been, the issues in 2020 or 21 or 22 are simply different to what they were 10, 15 or 20 or 30 years ago.
Nice.
So there absolutely is progress on all fronts.
That's good. That gives us all some hope. And I'm wondering as well whether the people that you interviewed that were a little older and have been in the workplace a little longer may have had different experiences for a couple of reasons. One, because they were in the workplace 20, 30 years ago when things were different, but also because possibly those people are in much more senior roles now. And I wonder whether as we rise through the ranks, we feel that things need to be different or we're treated differently or the people we're dealing with day to day are different and their views might be different. Did you see any of that in your research?
Yeah. So my research was people who work in leadership roles,
mm-hmm.
have managed a team of people for at least 2 years. And there were certain criteria in terms of the level that they had and the number of people that they had managed, simply so that I had a reasonably representative cohort that focused on the experience of leaders. In terms of your question there, in terms of people rising through the ranks and becoming more senior, for some people the experience was absolutely liberating and that they could affect change for the next generation coming through and mentor and create pathways and create environments where people from all kinds of persuasions can come to work and feel included and also be their authentic self and kind of get the job done. Because that's what we're here to do in business.
Yeah.
There was also this sort of much smaller cohort of senior leaders, and this was mainly older men and one woman in particular that I interviewed that suddenly found themselves going back into the closet, for want of a better term, as they became senior, simply because at a junior level, you know, they're much closer to the front line. You know, there's probably a little bit more social stuff and there's probably the stakes are different. But, you know, once they sort of get to that exec level or C-suite, all of a sudden it's about going to business class flights to Europe and golf days with, you know, clients and stuff. And there's a different expectation. And sometimes they've found that organisations or really senior people in organisations were unwittingly creating some, I guess you could call them discriminatory boundaries, but certainly they weren't as comfortable.
And I think it's interesting, and I wonder whether there is in some organisations at least still this kind of mould about what the C-suite needs to look like. And I sort of think back to women rising through senior roles in their 80s when they felt they had to dress in a certain way in suits, for example, become particularly masculine to fit the mould that was seen to be the C-suite. And I wonder whether there hasn't been a whole lot of shift maybe in the C-suite mould. In some organisations hasn't been a whole lot of shift, and there is still this either subconscious or very conscious, you know, feeling of a need to fit that mould that people might experience, which is which is interesting. And I don't see so much of that because I do work with smaller businesses, but I do find that really fascinating that there's still that potential that we've got that issue at highest levels. Because when I talk to people about creating culture in businesses and how we want people to behave and all of these things, I'm talking about things coming from the top down. And yet, as it seems to be working the reverse in some of the things you've seen, which is really fascinating.
Let me ask you a question. Have you ever felt like you've ever had to work harder than your co-workers to prove yourself and to be considered just as good?
Interesting question, actually. I don't know that I've had, and that's coming from, I guess, a place of being very fortunate and very privileged, that I haven't had that experience, but I purposefully did not spend a lot of time in very large organisations, and possibly because I could see that that would be something that I may have come across. I certainly did work with a very large, you know, banking and finance, actually, organisation when I was studying at uni. And I absolutely saw that across. I was really observing a lot working in that organisation. I was studying psychology, so that was a nice little tie-in. But I absolutely saw definitely elements of that in that workplace. But I think that's an experience a lot of people have, isn't it, that they have to, well, they feel as though they have to work a whole lot harder than others to get noticed, to get promotions. Was that challenges that you've seen or you've come across, either your consulting work or your research?
And look, every single person, as they're going through their career at some stage, has to put in the hard yards and works really hard and does that thing where you want to impress the boss and you want to demonstrate that you have that charisma or that leadership potential to go to the next level. So everybody has to do it.
Yep.
What I'm saying is that there are some people who feel like they have to work harder and have more to prove and also can't make as many mistakes because they won't be judged in a similar way than some other people in the workplace.
Mm. Yeah, and I want to circle back to this a little later and dig into it a little further. I think this has a really interesting sort of crossover when it comes to when we hire based on values, which is something I do encourage people to do because we want people that share values, otherwise we do have some conflict. But also in doing that, we only hire people often that are like us. And then if they're, and then I wonder whether that creates this issue with people who aren't like us, so to speak, and that creates that need for them to act in a certain way. I mean, I'm thinking of an accounting firm right now who, they're not a big accounting firm, but they hire people who are just like them, and you could look at their staff photo list, like to that level, you go, yep, they all work at this place because they're almost molds of each other. And that there's a whole lot of complexities that we won't dive into today in doing that, but it also just demonstrates that there can be some limitations when that's the only criteria that we're using.
So there's a couple of things that are worth digging into in that observation that you've just made. First up, from a recruiting perspective, this has been something that has been a recruiting, I guess, sticking point issue, if you want to call it, for, you know, ever since we've recruited people, in that we make recruiting and hiring decisions, we instantly connect with a candidate, particularly if we are hiring somebody that, you know, will be working for us in our team. I'm the direct manager involved in the hiring process. There is an unconscious bias that happens there when we meet people that have a similar personality and working style to us, because instantaneously we click with them, so we feel better about that hire. But actually, what we've learned from neuroscience research and from things like, you know, confirmation bias, is that we're actually confirming that we personally are good hires ourselves. Because if I hire that person over there that's like me in terms of how they were, and it does, you know, how that person looks, or their gender or their ethnicity, yep, background, that's less to do with it. But more, if I hire that person over there that acts and behaves like me, and, you know, I think that I'm a good worker, and I think that I have a good work ethic, then I am essentially confirming that. Mm. And that's not necessarily problematic as such. But if everybody's repeating that across the company, then we probably need to take a broader look at that to think about, well, are we necessarily just cloning a whole bunch of people, which may cause some issues for us down the track in terms of, you know, less creativity, less innovation, you know, less of a candidate pool, et cetera,
Yeah.
But I think the second point to jump into there is that how I think you made a comment about everybody looking the same.
I've seen that with other with companies that I've worked with. Yeah,
yeah, well,
very similar. You know, similar age, similar ethnicity. You know,
yeah.
You know, very similar characteristics across the board.
Yeah, and look. There's a difference between, you know, having people from diverse backgrounds and actually those people working in your organisation feeling like they belong there.
Mm.
And I think if we begin to get into the conversation about inclusion,
mm.
that's sort of one of the first major things that we need to talk about, because, you know, you can, every single person can look around their organisation and think about, oh yeah, but we hired that woman over there. She works in accounts. And what about that woman that we had, blah, 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 who did this role? She was great. People can always point to outliers,
yeah,
as an example, without yep. necessarily taking a look across the organisation, going, do we have a true diverse representation of our local community? You know, if that's important, if it's a regional place, yes. or whatever. And but secondly, does everybody feel like they've got a seat at the table? Do they all feel like they can yeah. speak up?
Yeah,
and do they feel like they belong here?
And that's what's important, I think. And you and I have spoken about the fundamental of that sense of belonging being around this concept of psychological safety, which I talk about, you know, quite a bit, I guess, in terms of the work I do. But really, for me, psychological safety at work is a feeling that I belong, that my contribution is valued, that I can speak up without fear, that I can own up to my mistakes, that I can try new things, that I can be innovative, I can suggest ideas. I don't know that that's a definition, but that's kind of how I sort of encapsulate psychological safety at work. Is that how you describe it, or do you have a definition that you sort of refer to, or what are your thoughts on psychological safety?
I think you've actually given a pretty bloody good definition of it there. I think... some good things to think about in terms of whether you've got a psychologically safe workplace is, okay, what happened to me last time I stuffed up and made a major mistake?
Yeah.
You know, is it a culture where people hide mistakes, or do people openly just go, you know what, we stuffed up or I stuffed up, and then we talk about it, we learn from it, and we move on?
Mm.
Amy Edmondson, who is probably the most famous author and speaker and about psychological safety, talks about the fact that in her original research on hospitals, nurses in hospitals in America, hospitals that reported higher mistakes and incidences actually had better team cultures. And she was looking at team culture within nursing professions as in her original research.
Mm.
And she thought the results would be the opposite. She thought that better cultures would produce fewer mistakes. But the bottom line was that the better culture teams actually reported more errors, yes. and reported more mistakes.
Yeah.
And so...
it's not that they were making more mistakes. They were just being honest about making them.
We don't learn unless we, you know, have that opportunity to talk about and make mistakes, and also, you know, have the conversation about that. And, you know... I will think back to the last time that I stuffed up and how my boss gave me feedback about yep. that in terms of how I approach the next idea that I have or the next project that I'm involved in. And so, you know, I can either be more collaborative, I can be more innovative, I can make better decisions, or I can retreat into threat mode and I can protect myself. Yep. And therefore, the company's not getting the best out of me. So there's a whole bunch
yes.
of business outcomes that we can link to psychological safety.
Mm. Yeah, and I think sometimes it's the smallest things too. Like, I'm thinking about businesses that I've worked with, and the staff will say to me, I always get told when I do the wrong thing, but I never ever get a thank you or that was great. And that does so much damage to a culture, but I do see it sort of come up a lot. And the other element of psychological safety and belongingness and those elements, and I've been talking about this topic a lot, it feels like lately, is trust. Do you trust your people? Because if you don't, they're not going to trust you. And that's just a spiral that you don't want to start going down. But I feel like this issue of trust seems to pop up a lot. And we've really got to build that trust, because that's where people will feel safe.
Yeah. Well, trust is a feeling. And, you know, I can't simply say, trust me, and, you know, you will. Trust is, I mean, if we think back to, one of the classic management authors that probably most of your listeners will know of, which is Stephen Covey, talks about that bank account of trust. It's all our actions and our behaviors. We either put money in deposits into it, or we take money out based on our actions and our behaviors. And trust, accountability, empowerment, all those things are so intimately linked with psychological safety.
And so when we're talking about workplace inclusivity, what we're really talking about is having a workplace where everyone feels like they belong. Is that right? Is that your perspective on things?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, absolutely, that's utopia, and
Yes.
it's what you want to get to. Different people are gonna reach that at different times. And if I think back to the work, the bread and butter work that I do every day, which is leadership training and coaching, it's still coming back to the basics every day. It's listening skills and questioning skills of leaders. It's how do you artfully and respectfully, in a good way, give constructive feedback that lands versus coming across as personal criticism? How often are you having robust conversations with your team and creating an environment where we all actually do speak up, so that we all, have that positive conflict versus, trying to all look at all conflict as being bad? Are you familiar with the work of, Tuchman's, forming, storming, norming, and performing model, that one?
Yes, I haven't done, yeah, I've heard of it, but not gone deep into it.
It's essentially the stages that a group go through as they sort of bond and get together to get to this, utopia of like a high-performing team. And one of the characteristics of a high-performing team is positive conflict, is the fact that we can debate ideas and issues rather than people and personalities. And if you think back, if you look at his model in terms of, the, I guess, the academic application of it, we go through these stages in a nice linear fashion. But in actual fact, if you've got a team of eight people, they're all going to take different times to come to that stage of performing. As a leader and or as a small business owner, our ability to be able to really sort of take that helicopter view and kind of go, what's this person doing over here? And what do I need to do to help make them feel included, to give them more trust and the power to bring them along, versus just going, they're not pulling their weight and they're not bonding with everybody else. So that's obviously their problem.
That's a really great point about the importance of looking at individuals and not assuming a one size fits all approach, or I wrote a policy, we're all good, which is, I've got all the policies, cool, what are you doing with them? And I talk a lot about curiosity and being more curious with our teams, because I just think we're really bad sometimes at making assumptions, jumping to conclusions, thinking that we know what they're feeling or thinking. And I think we all need to be more curious every day as leaders, because when we do that, we will listen better. We will try to better understand where each individual's at. But I think having, especially in small business, because you can, having that individual approach, you don't have 1,000 people, you've got 20. So you can understand where each individual's at to help them to, map a path for them to come to that. And I think that we're not always really good at that.
It's true, but in defense of small business owners and small people who
We've
work
got a few things going on.
they're bloody busy. We know that one of the biggest killers of things like creativity is capacity. And so often I'm so busy working in the business that I can't necessarily take that helicopter or that dance floor view or kind of, whatever analogy you want to use. But I can kind of circle back to something that you just said there around, getting curious and making those assumptions. I can't remember the name of the author who said, "Get curious, not furious."
Oh, I don't know, but I'm going to borrow that. I'm going to find who they were.
Might have been Matt Lieberman, it might have been David Rock, or somebody like that. But I thought that that's a really good way of framing, because we get mad as individuals, and when you actually realize that you are actually furious or actually getting mad for somebody, like going, "Hang on, get curious. That's interesting. Where is that coming from? Why am I feeling this way? And how could I frame this differently?" Because we always assume bad, and we often assume bad intent in other people when we see their behavior, but we never assume bad intent in ourselves.
That's
We
very true.
are, yeah, I judge you on your behavior, but I judge me on my intention to behave.
Yes. Yeah, that's interesting because I'm always, saying have a curious conversation because what you think is going on is not what's going on. But flip that around, and we need to be more curious about our own reactions.
Yeah,
And
most
yeah, I think that's a really interesting reframe on that. And I think, when we're talking about creating workplaces where people feel like they belong, where there is inclusivity for everyone in the workplace. And I think it's really interesting because we talk a lot about certain cohorts, certain groups. Last year, I was chatting to a neurodivergence expert. And, so she's really focusing on those groups. But everyone in your workplace should feel like they equally belong because when they do, they, like you mentioned earlier, they show up and they be their best selves. Their performance is going to be higher. They're happier, they're more motivated, all the flow-on effects we always talk about in HR. But it's unless you are checking your own reactions and talking to individuals and really understanding individuals, I think is where it comes down to, you're not going to get to that utopia that you talk about.
Yeah.
Is there a particular challenge or set of challenges you see businesses face when it comes to this? Is it that they're sticking their head in the sand and not paying enough attention? Is it that their intention's good but their actions aren't? Like, what do you see as common sort of challenges with the businesses you work with?
So the first thing that I will say is that it's getting better across the board. I've been a leadership facilitator for 14 years now, running my own business, micro business, I guess you'd call me. And I'm dealing, I'm probably doing, I don't know, 100, 120, 130 training sessions a year, maybe whether they be half day or whole day. So if you multiply that by 12, that's the amount of leaders I'm seeing across my cohorts every year. And there is absolutely a shift in terms of people wanting to be better leaders and actually workplaces generally getting better. Now, certain industries are not getting there as quick as other industries. And there's some cultural and organizational and also perception barriers for that. But, maybe there will. It still comes back to the basics, though, of being able to have good conversation skills and be able to have a good, honest conversation with my teams and also with my one-up manager and feel like that we listen to each other, that we respect each other, but also that we actually know each other. Now, where the inclusion part gets tricky for some people is that because there's been such a focus on diversity and inclusion efforts, I'll say for the last 25 years, but really it's ramped up in the last sort of 5 to 7.
Agree.
A lot of new language that's out there. I mean, there's words that I've had to learn that I didn't even know until I started my PhD. And it's made me insufferable or more insufferable at dinner parties than I used to be. But thank you. I think what's happening is that in the race or in the journey to inclusion, there's a whole bunch of language, there's a whole bunch of people coming through that are very confident in who they are. And some people are feeling a little left behind, potentially a little bit threatened, but also just not knowing how to go forward. And so, and I was my uni supervisor, who she's what's called an intersectionality expert. Intersectionality being, this broad sense that we need to consider the whole of ourselves in terms of our multiple selves from an organizational perspective and from an individual perspective. And she talks about, and we talk about the fact that a lot of organizations just want a bit of a tick and flick. Put a policy together, do a half day's training for diversity, and boom, we're done. I can come into your company and do a half day training course, and people will have much better feedback giving skills. But a half day course on diversity is going to just create a whole bunch of questions because with diversity and inclusion, what we're actually doing is we're getting to the sense of people's core identity. I start to really bring my whole self to work in terms of, my background, my age, my social status, my class, my trauma, my backgrounds, all the stuff that's going on for me and my family, sexuality, all that kind of stuff. People have got their own wheelbarrow to push outside of the workplace. And back in the day, it was just like you leave your private life at home, once your work come in the door, you just forget about it. That's not going to cut it in 2023.
No. And if you got any young people in your workplace, you'll know that by now because they will quite openly let you know what they expect from work. And it is that work is part of their life and life is part of their work. And that's their approach. It's interesting that what everything always comes back to is communication and the ability to listen, have conversations, communicate. Like it's but it always fundamentally comes back to that piece. And it is a piece that the reason that there's so much training available, and you know, you and I are coaches and consultants in this space, is because people find it hard. And I really like that you pointed out to the language, because there is new language, and I think some people do find that they just don't know, and they want to be very respectful, and they want to say the right things, and they get worried that they're going to say the wrong things as well. I think I said that down a bit, but fundamentally, folks, it all comes back to your communication.
Thanks for joining us on this episode. If you enjoyed the podcast, please leave us a rating, comment, and review wherever you listen to your podcasts. And don't forget to recommend us to a friend. We also love hearing suggestions for topics or guest speakers that you would love to hear from. The best way to reach us to give us those suggestions is over on our Facebook page. Simply head to Facebook and search Grow Your Influence. See you there.